You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT. Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
radio.mmt@gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. You're with Anne and Kev yet again. How are you, Anne?
Good, Kev. How are you? And hello to our lovely listener, who I'm sure is listening with rapt attention.
Yes, indeed. And this week we have a guest, a very welcome guest, Professor Bill Mitchell, who is well known in MMT circles because he kind of invented the thing.
Mm.
Yeah. How are you, Bill?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent.
And Bill is literally in the studio with us today.
In the studio for the first time. We've had Bill pre-recorded on interviews and stuff before, but he's actually live in the studio this time, which is lovely to have his very happy smiling face. But yeah, which is behind a mask because he's very conscientious and that's a very good thing. This week we thought we'd delve into the connection between Marxism and MMT, and this caught my attention a little while ago. I was reading the Jacobin magazine. I was trying to get my head around it. There seems to be some sort of conflict between socialists and MMT, particularly with the more reactionary socialists, where I think the way you'd phrase it is that anybody who tries to make capitalism comfortable, they regard as acting against socialism. Socialism wants revolution, and if we make capitalism comfortable, then the revolution is not going to happen. And it sort of got me thinking, Bill's very famous for, you're very famous for the job guarantee, which if it was successful in being implemented, and incidentally it's being discussed at the ALP conference by the Unionists for a Job Guarantee, are trying to get in there this week. So, you know, well done, Bill, for an amazing initiative, which is now on the political forefront. But the concept is that if you make people comfortable in capitalism, then socialism's never going to occur because, like, it's everybody's too cozy where they are. And I don't know. The Jacobin magazine didn't support that case, but it did raise that issue that some socialists regard these sorts of measures as counterproductive. And I thought, well, who better to discuss these sorts of things than Bill Mitchell himself? Because you describe yourself as a Marxist, Bill. Would that be correct?
No, I'm not anyist.
Right.
I'm a socialist, I guess.
A socialist, yeah. But
my foundations in economics are from Marx.
From what I gather, you're impressed by the work of Marx, the way he thinks, his ideology, or his sense of economics.
Well, impressed sounds like a fanboy, and that's sort of not what it is. It's, to me, we live in a specific historical epoch called capitalism.
Yep.
And that has distinctive features that separate it from previous systems of production, like feudalism and slavery. And Marx, in my view, was the only pure scholar that understood the essential characteristics of capitalism. And as an economist, as a person who's, you know, been through the various degree programs up to through the PhD in economics and worked all my life in the academy, the dominant framework for understanding capitalism within the academy of, you know, among economists is just simply wrong. You know, you can approach Marx's work at various levels, and, you know, a lot of people attack his work because of predictive failure. And what I mean by that is that some of the predictions he made in the middle of the 19th century are yet to come to fruition. And they say, oh, well, he must, you know, they dispense with him as being of any use. But I think that's a fairly shallow way of understanding his work. And for me, the intrinsic value of his work above all else is how he got to the nitty-gritty of capitalism, how he understood that it was very different from feudalism and had defining characteristics that a superficial level analysis doesn't reveal. And I can tell you what they are, but
I'm not pretending to be a scholar of Marx. I don't pretend to be a scholar of anything. But what I understand is that the environment that Marx and Engels were existing in was a fairly brutal form of industrialization. They're sort of a rugged ground to be a worker, where exploitation was rife and a lot more noticeable, a lot more obvious, where you've got, you know, child labour and people working long hours with really poor conditions. So the exploitation was obvious and you could see it. But over the years, workers kind of become... you've got people in middle management or upper management who don't regard themselves as workers. They're earning a salary, but they regard themselves as something else, as kind of like middle management, even though they're not the owners of production as such. They're still working for somebody else. And so you end up with this kind of multi-leveled thing where some workers don't feel exploited. They feel as if they're lucky. They're a step up. And there's this kind of class thing where they're not working class. They're now management class. They don't own the business, but they don't regard themselves as working class. And so the struggle of workers gets kind of hidden because some of these workers don't feel that there's much of a struggle. That kind of causes confusion, I guess. And I'm wondering whether, what would you call more revolutionary socialists, that's their issue. They're saying that if you make capitalism too comfortable, then you're not going to get the reaction that is required for what, however capitalism goes to socialism. What they want is a revolution.
Well, it's what I want too, but, you know, there's various ways in which academics and researchers have created classifications of class, and what you were just describing is really a conflation of different classifications, which is sort of invalid. The sociologist C. Wright Mills had a sociological concept of class, where we had lower classes and middle class and you know, upper classes and stratifications within it, you know, more finely grained stratifications within each. From that perspective, as a professional worker, me, if, you know, a stable job and good salary, I'm middle class. But I'm still, from a Marxian perspective, working class. And I'm working class because in a Marxian perspective, there are only two classes, the capital class and the labour class, the working class. And the distinction is very clear. If you don't have to work for survival because you own capital that can be put to work with workers to generate surplus value, which you can realise through sales as profits, then you're part of the capital class. If you have to work and sell your labour power in order to survive, that is to get an income, then you're part of the working class. All workers have a choice you know, in a sense of who you work for, but you don't have a choice of working or not. And, you know, I mean, welfare states have blurred that a little bit with systems of welfare and income support systems. But essentially for the vast majority of people, we're working class because we have to work to survive. I can't exploit surplus value from another human, whereas that's the definition of a person in the capitalist class. You know, there's a lot of research being done by scholars in this area to discuss the way in which elites, capital, introduce dynamics into the society to blur the Marxian class differences, to create structures within the working class that can then be set against each other, you know, the so-called divide and conquer strategies. And, you know, we saw that in dramatic form in, you know, 1974-75 in Australia, where unemployment started to become a problem after the first OPEC oil crisis, the price shocks. A minister in the Labor government introduced the term dole bludger, Clyde Cameron.
Yeah.
Clyde Cameron, minister, he was the minister for Labor. You know, so the Australian government was perceiving a problem, rising unemployment for the really the first time in decades, rather than see the problem as in an intrinsic sense, not enough jobs, which they were contributing to the lack of jobs because they were starting, you know, this was the beginning of sort of austerity mindsets.
Now, was this around the time, Bill Hayden was treasurer at this time, and was he receiving advice or did he entertain Milton Friedman around that time?
Milton Friedman came to Australia at that time. Some very interesting economists came to Australia at that time. But, yeah, Milton Friedman was dignified, and I attended a lecture at Monash University at the time when he came out, and I won't say what
you were. You were there at a Milton Friedman lecture.
I attended his public lecture. He was the only adult I've ever seen whose feet don't touch the ground when he's sitting in a chair. He was a tiny man, but he had a huge influence.
Yeah,
and. So the point I was making was that introducing nomenclature like dole bludger was a way in which they could divert blame of their own role in creating that unemployment and creating stratifications within the working class because they wanted to encourage the rest of us who still had jobs to believe that we were hard working. And the unemployed were indolent.
Victim blaming as such.
Yeah. So capital over the history has used things like ethnicity, race, particularly there's a lot of work done in America on the way in which the working class was divided by the media and capital, you know, through racism. If you hate the blacks, then they're not part of, they can't be possibly part of the working class.
Well, if you're an exploited worker, at least you're not a black slave. And so you end up with this class structure.
And, you know, I mean, migrants have historically been targeted as undermining the prosperity. And we're seeing it right today.
Yeah,
now,
it's the same strategy used time and time again.
You know, migrants are taking our jobs. They're taking, and in the modern sense, they're taking our houses.
Yep.
And all of that. So these are all strategies that have been used over the course of history.
It's amazing that they can use the same repeat strategies time and time again, and we have to keep on fighting back against the same ridiculous, unbased arguments all the time. I mean, it's just history repeating itself. Well, we never seem to learn.
Well, we know when economic times get tough, racism within the society increases.
Right.
And that's because it's deliberately manipulated by the political class to push away blame for themselves. You know, in the current situation, why have we got not enough housing, affordable housing? It's because the state governments went on an austerity trip about two decades ago and stopped building social housing.
Yeah, no public housing, which means those people who would otherwise be in public housing are now competing with people in the private rental market. And we hear this constant argument that we just need to build more houses and that will solve the problem. However, if the houses are being built by the private market, they're not going to flood the market with houses and drive prices down. That goes against their business model. They're going to drip feed properties to keep prices as high as they possibly can. So,
I mean, you know, 40 years ago, the state government was a large builder. State governments were large builders of social housing.
Yeah, it's halved since 1999.
There's 800,000. We've got a shortage of around 800,000 houses now, in that segment of the market, the social, what we now call social housing, used to be called the housing commission market.
Yeah,
and you know, that's because of lack of investment.
Yeah, so a deliberate lack of investment. It's there to keep the property market buoyant for people selling and investors.
Not really, Kevin. It was really the motivation of the state governments was to run surpluses.
Right.
It was an economic motivation. They thought that the debt heavens were going to fall in on them, and so they went on, you know, it was the whole neoliberal thing in the 1980s where state treasurers started to cut back on capital expenditure.
Now, this kind of comes to the an interesting, we're talking about socialism and how it interacts with MMT, and one thing I hear constantly repeated by those on the left is that we need to increase taxes on the wealthy so that they can pay for the services that we need. And in so doing, they build a reliance on profit-driven enterprises to fund the economy. And this is where I think MMT could become very useful for socialists, if they could understand that dynamic simply is just wrong. It's false.
You know, I got an email this afternoon from the Australia Institute inviting me to put my name and therefore my public persona on an advertisement, a letter, one of those sort of letters from economists type
public things, yeah.
Yeah, that they were going to publish in all the national newspapers, I understand. And it was about the gas, the validity.
Increasing the taxes on gas exports.
Yeah, yep. And within that, there was no way I could put my name as a signatory, because in there they said that this will give the government crucial money to fund progress in education and health and all of that stuff. And, you know, this is the problem, that we've got large progressive platforms who get media attention and get investment funds put into them by progressive financing, who just completely miss the point.
Yeah.
To me, as a socialist, a much more powerful narrative would be, we need to tax the rich, not because we want their money, but because we want them to have less money. And why do we want them to have less money? Because then they'll be less able to control the media, control the airwaves, and control the whole lobbying of our politicians and distort legislation in their favour. That's why we want to tax the rich. We don't want their money. We don't. The federal government doesn't need their money. It's got as much money as they like. It's got infinity minus a cent.
This is a point which I think we need to try and communicate to anybody who's progressively economically minded, particularly the socialists, is that if all money is created by the government, and if the government creates the money, it should be controlling the economy. It doesn't need to be doesn't need to relinquish that control to wealthy profit-driven individuals or organisations, because essentially anybody that has any money has public money. It's a public utility.
You've conflated two points there.
Yeah.
The important point that everybody should understand is that the federal government has unlimited dollars at its disposal because it's the only entity that issues that currency. That's the first point. Everybody should understand that, because once you understand that, then a whole lot of things that you think are inevitable or unsolvable or or natural, and like mass unemployment, for example, go away. Because once you understand that, then you will understand that the federal government can buy whatever is for sale in the Australian dollar without question. Without question. Now, the thing that the next point that you then added to that was that the federal government should control everything. Well, that's a separate issue, and you don't have to hold that view to understand the implications of the first point. The first point is that the federal government can never run out of Australian dollars. It's the only body that issues them. We use their currency. That's it. So if you want to have good public hospitals and you want to have good public housing and you want to revitalise our degraded higher education sector and all those things, and you want to deal with climate change...
Could we say that if you want the state to have more control over the economy...
Look, I think you run the danger then of getting into discussions about control and thought police and all of that. because then you've lost the first point in a way. I think the first point, you can have a totally market-driven economy and the first point is still valid. And then the government's just using its currency within a market-driven economy. And you'll get much better outcomes than you've got now. Now, if you want to add the next layer of how much of the market-driven activity you want to control through regulation or direct control, then that's the next step in the debate.
And I suppose this comes back to the earlier point, is that this depends on how effective the democracy or the whatever style of government you want to run. If it becomes corrupted by corporate interests, and those corruptions might be legal, but if they're being lobbied, if they're not reflecting the well-being of the electorate that they're serving, then you see a system evolving like ours and is being magnified in the United States, where everything's upside down, where the democratic process has been corrupted through corporate lobbying to the point where it no longer the government is no longer serving the people who voted them in the first place.
Yeah, a progressive economy can't possibly allow the scale of lobbying and consultancies and all of that influence that we have now. A progressive politician should be advocating to minimise lobbying,
It should be abolished. I mean,
Got to have lobbying could be functionally important because because
depends what you're lobbying for. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you and I and Anne and we've got just small voices in the world, and we would like to. It's like why do you want a trade union? Well, you want a trade union because they can represent the interests of many to one.
To advocate for something.
Yeah, to advocate for something. So lobbying per se is not intrinsically bad, but the scale at which and the bias towards the elites who control it, that's bad.
When it's driven by profit, too much profit, then. Is it possible to attain any profit without exploitation?
Well, not in a Marxian sense. See, previously you used the term exploitation, and I didn't say anything, but you used it in a generic way, in which, the average person, if you like, whatever that is, would understand it. But that's not the way Marx understood it. Marx understood exploitation as being a worker who generates value greater than they're returned in the form of pay. That's exploitation.
Surplus value.
Is it? Surplus value. And for him, all workers are exploited, not just, I'm exploited as a professor of economics, just as much as a low-wage worker in a sweatshop is exploited. Now, the conditions of the exploitation are clearly different, that's true. But from an academic perspective, that's the sort of meaning of capitalism, It's funny you mentioned Milton Friedman's visit, because around that time, and I'm just thinking when it might have been, probably 1979 or something, I was a graduate student at Monash University then. We had a visit from the two senior economists in Comecon, which was the Soviets' planning agency. And it was very interesting.
Milton Friedman on the one hand and the Soviet Union on the other.
It was a really interesting talk. And when it came time for questions, I asked, you know, as a Bolshe young graduate student, I asked a question. And I said, can you explain to me, you've talked a lot about exploitation tonight and all of this. And I said, can you explain to me how a worker in Clayton, because Monash is located in Clayton, and in that at that period of time, a lot of factories still existed in Clayton. They had all the motor car, Datsun and Volkswagen and those factories. And I said, can you explain to me how a worker in Clayton who gets up in the middle of winter at, 5:30, 6 o'clock, freezing cold, goes to the factory in Clayton, works in a boring job all day, crunching out widgets, has a reasonably secure job and pay, but not high pay, but reasonable pay. And, you know, can you tell me how they're different to a worker in Moscow, getting up in the morning, going to a factory, pumping out widgets? And what I was trying to get to is how they conceived their version of socialism relative to capitalism for the ordinary worker, not the elites in the planning agency. And they said to me, very good question, and I made the additional point that all workers, whether they're in a socialist system or a capitalist system, have to be exploited, have to create surplus value. And the reason is, I mean, you think about it, a worker who produces capital goods like machine goods and that, where are they going to get food from? Well, the worker who produces the food has to produce more food than they eat themselves, because they've got to feed others who don't produce any food. So all workers, whether it's a capitalist system or a socialist system, have to be exploited in the sense of creating surplus value, doing longer labour than they need to survive themselves. That's the definition.
So what answer did you get from the...
They said to me, very interesting, they said the difference from their perspective is that the surplus value created in the socialist system in the USSR went to the common good. Whereas the surplus value in capitalism goes to a very small elite group to perpetuate their power and their well-being, and that the existence of that surplus value and what it means leads to a whole lot of other dynamics in capitalism to maintain the hegemony of capital. That's what they told me.
It's an interesting thing. I ran into a guy, I was going to a gig in Collingwood at the Tote the other night. I ran into a fellow called Peter at a restaurant beforehand, and he was from East Germany. He's about the same age as me, and he was brought up in East Germany when it was part of the USSR, and I asked him about it, and he said that I asked him specifically about, so where did you live? And he said, oh, I lived in an apartment block. And I said, well, was it expensive? He said it was very cheap. And so all the things that he needed were provided. But he described it as grey. And then he also came to the understanding that that Germany wasn't particularly liked by the USSR after World War II. And he said that they weren't treated very well by the USSR because of the relationship. 20 million Russians died during World War II at the hands of the Germans, and so there might have been a bit of payback going on there as well. But it's kind of like, I guess the thing is, in a capitalist world, you're fearful that if you haven't got work, you're going to lose your home, you're not going to have enough food. In a socialist environment, would you have more security?
Well, I remember I did some work for the Asian Development. I've done quite a lot of work for the Asian Development Bank, and one of the projects was in Kazakhstan, not long after the collapse of the Soviet Union. the first set of meetings were in Almaty, which is one of the big cities in Kazakhstan, and the driver picked me up from the airport. The Asian Development Bank had got drivers to pick me up. And we were coming, just leaving the airport, and I sort of noticed all these little tin shacks just beside the road. And I said to him, I said, well, what the hell are they? And he went and told me the story. He said that before the Soviet system had collapsed, all the workers were in apartments that were state apartments. They had fixed rent. He said they were very modest. But he said that the people who had worked all their lives in pretty harsh conditions, it's really cold out there, out in the east of that part of Asia. He said they worked really hard all their lives. They were given modest pensions, but they had a house that had heating. They had enough food, and they could go to a club and play cards or something, and I said, what happened? And he said, after the Soviet system fell apart, guys like Jeffrey Sachs, the American economist, went in there with the shock therapy. Mm. Remember that shock therapy?
No.
Anne's nodding. She remembers it. Shock therapy was, we've got to have a hard market reality imposed upon these people. So he told me that, suddenly the market reality was market-based rents.
Right.
And pensions were scrapped. Mm. And so these people in these little tin shacks were people who had worked all their lives, pensioners.
Right.
Who had worked all their lives, lost their pensions, lost their apartments, and were now begging.
Welcome to the free market.
It's a stark example, isn't it?
And the only people that were still in salubrious circumstances were being supported by their children who were prospering in the market economy.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
You're on 3CR this week. Our guest is Professor Bill Mitchell. Bill, your work is not always appreciated by those who we might regard as allies.
For years and years I've had critics, left-wing critics, who've told me that sort of my work on welfare and improving the circumstances of the most disadvantaged citizens in Australia is really antithetical to the achievement of socialism, and that really all that I was... all my academic work was about band-aids to keep capitalism functioning.
Mm.
And, this goes back to the 1970s when I'd go to Australian political economy conferences as a graduate student and then as a young academic and on and on. I keep running into Marxists, alleged Marxists, who tell me this, and that what we really should be doing is fighting for the revolution and whatever. And I guess my reply to them is that, look, when we're ready for a revolution, I'll be on the barricades. But I prefer not to spend my time in salubrious cafes on Saturday mornings after having, with my secure job and well-paid job, going out for a latte on a Saturday morning with an almond croissant, plotting the revolution, and that if we can help, in my view, the next day improve the circumstances tomorrow and the next day for the most disadvantaged Australians and people anywhere, then a socialist with humanity has to do that. Mm. And even if it delays the revolution by a day, I think we're going to be a better people for doing that, because the bottom line is that we're nowhere near a revolution.
No.
And that are we just going to wait and waste people's lives and prosperity and happiness while we articulate some academic narrative with our secure circumstances? I just couldn't live with that.
This old argument or debate of revolution versus reform. And I'm wondering, you did publish a book, or you co-authored a book with Thomas Farsi called Reclaiming the State.
Mm.
And I was wondering if I was correct to read that as like a third way, almost like reclaiming versus revolution versus reform.
Well, I mean, always the debate, you know, through my life has been, do you have evolutionary socialism or revolutionary socialism? And revolutionary socialism is, you know, really bloodletting and paybacks and all of that.
Mm.
And, you know, the debate was always about, do the means kill the end? Do you become so brutal and destructive that you can't possibly then next day, once you've overthrown the capitalist class, I've got inverted commas here, do you then become all sweet and
wake up in utopia?
Yeah, and I guess my philosophical view was that evolutionary socialism is a better way to do it, because the means do corrupt the ends in some circumstances, and I think brutality should be avoided. And you know, my view always has, at the moment, in my spare time, I'm watching The Americans, which is on SBS, and it's a fantastic series.
Oh, I've been looking for something to watch.
About spies, and it's
I had two Americans with guns, and I thought, I don't want to see Americans
guns. It's real. I hate American programs that are gee whiz America. This is about KGB spies who are embedded within American society and do all sorts of plotting and that.
Right, okay, I'll give it a look.
You know, their lives are brutal because they're up against the FBI and the CIA, who are also brutal.
Mm.
And it's a really interesting series about how that changes people's feelings about their mission.
Mm.
And so I think, yeah, that you know, if only East Germany had treated its people more nicely.
Yeah.
And I think freedom's important, personal freedom's important. And in that sense, I'm sort of a libertarian. And I think that you've got to appeal to people's natural good and their intellect to get social change. You've got to get people on side to say, yeah, this is important for humanity. And I don't think you do that with a gun.
Mm.
And so my view is that reclaiming the state is about grassroots movements, community movements, spreading out and convincing people that a progressive way of doing things and an abandonment of capitalism, which is the antithesis of progressiveness, is the way to go. And we just do it through the way in which we select and advance our political class, and we do it that way.
Mm.
And I think that's always been my view. Whether it would ever happen that way is unclear, because, you know, I'm on the public record as saying that I believe that ultimately capitalism will fail because of climate change.
Mm.
And I think that that will be a brutal transition, not necessarily because of guns and violence, but because of starvation and...
Yeah, and basic needs are not going to be met.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's projections that 75% of humanity is going to have to die through the desertification of food bowls and all of that stuff. And if that transpires, and if the Southern Europe food bowl dies, which it's dying, then where's Europe going to get its food? Well, Europe's got military. They'll go down to Africa and they'll take over food there. And, you know, that's sort of probably the most realistic.
We've already seen, haven't we, like a crisis instigate, like taking over ideology and instigating spending by the government during the COVID lockdowns. Like we saw a conservative government having to do almost Keynesian style spending.
Yeah, I think everybody now, whether that everybody admits it, but everybody now knows that a lot of that stuff about fiscal deficits and governments running out of money and governments collapsing with debt, I think people now intrinsically know that's just false. Mm-hmm. And the GFC demonstrated that, and then we sort of forgot about it, and then the COVID demonstrated it absolutely categorically. And you know, the current ridiculous thing going on in the Middle East, where the amount of money, public money, that's getting shot across the skies every few minutes.
And literally blowing up.
Just destroyed. Yeah. Just like, and you know, there's no limit to it.
Mm.
And there is no limit to it other than the metal that can be created to build the munitions. I think people are sort of, you know, the essential nature of neoliberalism is now in its end state.
It's getting to the pointy end, and it's
not
becoming
working.
More. I mean, Trump is not the problem. He's the result of an ideology.
And I mean, there was a big report issued in Australia yesterday that essentially came out on the job services industry, you know, which was just damning and just saying that this is a failed system,
mm-hmm.
that is only serving the interests of a small group of private equity profiteering interests. You know, I mean, things are coming out all the time just on all the different things about that neoliberalism has been characterised by to demonstrate that it's failed and we're moving on.
And I guess this is where the discontent is coming from that's currently being fed towards things like One Nation. But the discontent is real. It's choosing a poor antidote with a lot of the right-wing populism that's going on. But the what you're describing is a system which is failing people.
Yeah, but and One Nation, I mean, the traditional political classes are just not in a position to give voice to that sort of anxiety, because they've been active architects and participants in developing neoliberalism.
Yeah, yep.
You know, and One Nation will burn out. I mean, they can't.
I think they've peaked already. So.
because essentially they've got nothing but a voice for that anxiety. Oh, we'll help you, and they make anti-establishment statements, but when it gets down to what they're going to do,
they got nothing. They got more problems, not
and
not solutions.
And they're internally corrupt. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's our role, Kevin, is to keep the story alive about exactly what you can do with the fiscal capacity of the government.
Yes, and I'll mention it again. You can talk about all these people, the latte socialists of years gone by. You've got Unionists for a Job Guarantee currently proposing a lot
in Adelaide,
they're there supporting your work,
and I thank them very much for that.
And that could result in real change. So well done, Bill.
Yeah, I think the system will change. It'll evolve. It has to. It's just how quickly it'll evolve, given how quick climate change is closing in on us.
Yeah,
that's the huge challenge at the moment, I think. There was a reason why trade unions and the welfare state emerged in the late 19th century. It's because capitalism had become so awful that humanity couldn't cope with it anymore.
And we've now got a socialist mayor in New York. You can see little signs of this flaring up again. Where people,
although he's announced he can't arrest Netanyahu.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Unfortunately. But
fantastic speech for anybody who hasn't seen it. Check it out. Yeah. Thank you, Bill. You better go and support those demons to overcome those terrible cats. It's been lovely having you in.
Thank you.
I'm going to see you out with a song by the Brooklyn Funk Essentials explaining that the revolution was postponed because of rain.
Thank you.
Cool and steady and easy and make them like. Whoa! The revolution was postponed because of rain. The underlying immediate political, socio-economic and trigger mechanism causes were all in place when some Negro or the other got hungry, had to stop at the McDonald's, had to get on the line with a new trainee cashier. Where's the button for the fries? So we missed the bus. Then the leader couldn't find his keys. Didn't want some poor ass moving his brand new 20-inch and VCR out his living room on the shoulders. It was too late when the locksmith came. Then our demo expert, Willie Blue, got arrested. Came out with his head hanging under his hoodie. Didn't know they started doing that for jumping the turnstiles, he said. How many times must we tell you? Don't get caught. We voted against shooting him on the spot. In the winter we were all depressed, so we leaned our guns up against the sofas and listened instead to Tim Tim Therese singing about his dysfunctions. He sang, sometimes I wonder if I'll ever be free, free of the sins of my brutish daddy life, the cheating, the stealing, the drinking, and the beating. The weatherman said the 17th would be sunshine and it wouldn't be too hot. Tim Tim Therese doesn't like sweating. But that night the weatherman came on crying, saying he didn't control the weather, that God was real, that he's lucky he, God, didn't strike him, the weatherman, with lightning for taking the credit sometimes, and that he, the weatherman, was in no way responsible for the hurricane coming, and that we, the viewers, should pray Jesus into our hearts before it was too late. Super Bowl Sunday was out. All the women wanted to see the game, and the men were pissed at their insensitivity. The 20th was supposed to be a definite. We looked for some Bastille to storm, didn't find any. Settled on the armory instead before they moved the homeless in. We'll bum rush it anyway, I said. It smells like a collection of 1,000 farts in there, they said. So we waited for the approval of the city contract to build a Bastille, which set the revolution back 5 years. On Tuesday, she was in a pissed off mood. Her tax return didn't come in time for the rent, but they showed the We Are the World video on cable that evening, and we all held hands and cried to stop from laughing, and our anger subsided. Looking back, it could have been a plot, but there are more substantive plots to expose than the We Are the World conspiracy. Now we wait for the rain to stop. All forces on the alert. Some in Brooklyn basements, packed in between booming speakers, listening to Shabarangs and Arrested Development, boggling and doing the East Coast stomp, gargling with Bacardi and Brown Cow, breaking that monotony with slow movements, slow hip grinding movements, with the men breathing in the women's ears to earth, wind and fire's reasons, and wondering what the weather will be like next weekend.
Been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.